This is a Dharmanet presentation.
Okay, so for this evening's talk, I would like to talk a little bit on the topic of... keep going in suspense. The topic of jhana. Sorry, who said, oh dear? Because, of course, the reason that the Buddha taught the jhanas was in order to make you feel inadequate. It was to make you think that you are no good, and that only by getting to something far away and unattainable could you do anything worthwhile with your life. No, not really, I just made that up. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about jhanas and what it means, why it's important, and how we can practice. The first thing to remember when we're thinking about things like this is that when we approach the subjects, it's always, I think, useful, or I think it always works out for me. If you approach the topic from a perspective of thinking, well, probably this Buddha fellow knew what he was talking about. Okay? So sometimes when you encounter things, you might think, I don't understand that, how is that relevant for me, it seems weird or whatever. But just take it a bit slowly, just not to say that you should blindly accept everything, but just to say, sort of, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt. He taught these things, it's part of the Eightfold Path, therefore it's something you should have an interest in and should try to understand. And probably, by understanding it, you'll find something out that's very worthwhile. One of the interesting and important things about the jhanas and the way the Buddha had described them was that they're one of the, I think, earliest and one of the most important descriptions anywhere of particular states of mind, states of consciousness. And so by describing these states of consciousness in a way that's very clear and very powerful, then the Buddha's giving us something we can orientate ourselves towards, something that we can give us a perspective in our practice. Where is our practice going to? Now, in contemporary Buddhism and Buddhist meditation circles, jhanas have become very controversial. People like to argue about them a lot. I haven't yet heard of any cases where arguing about them actually help you to get them, but nevertheless, that doesn't seem to stop anyone. Anyway, so I'm not going to go into the various controversies about jhanas, whether you need them or don't need them, and exactly how you define them, and so on and so forth, but I'm just going to sort of present it as straightforward as I can, my understanding of these things and why they're important and what they are. You can, I mean, it's just important to know that, because if you're reading around or you look at different essays on the internet or listen to different talks, then you will hear different points of view, okay? So just to understand that so that you don't get too confused about it. Of course, you know, if you want to have a sort of guide to the different points of view, then it's very simple. You just know that my description is right, and if anyone disagrees with that, then they're wrong. It's very easy. And I'm only half joking. Okay. All right. So jhanas are how the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path, right? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. Right samadhi is always defined as the four jhanas, okay? Now, there are various other states of meditation, which are somewhat more exotic, that are mentioned in the Buddha's teachings, and I won't talk about them this evening. The four jhanas are the ones which are talked about most commonly and always in the most central place. Other ones are a bit more peripheral, okay? That's kind of the bling, right? You can kind of, that's the spinning rims and the chrome and stuff like that you can use. But the jhanas is, the Buddha said that the jhanas is like the axle of the vehicle. So you think I just make up these similes, but no, there's actual simile where the Buddha compares the different parts of the Eightfold Path to a chariot, okay? And the jhanas are the axle of the chariot, okay? So it's absolutely fundamental. You can't drive a chariot without an axle. The wheels fall off, right? So, you know, the Dhamma wheels are going to fall off unless you've got the axles. Okay. It's useful to, so just a basic description so that you have some idea what we're talking about. Jhanas are something which is a state of profound meditation which emerge as an outcome when we're practicing meditation. So for example, if you sit down, you watch your breath, your mind becomes very peaceful. Doesn't matter what meditation object you use, if you use loving kindness meditation, or you meditate on light, or meditate on a meditation word, or whatever it is, any kind of meditation that you use can lead to your mind becoming peaceful. And if you let your mind become more and more and more peaceful, it will follow that process. And ultimately, if you let it, and if the mind abandons all the hindrances, then it will emerge into this state of jhana. Okay, so the jhana, in a sense, is the outcome of a process of meditation. Jhanas themselves are states of very, very powerful, still and clear consciousness. So there's no thought, there's no awareness of your body, there's no movement of the mind, there's no hindrances, there's just a very powerful sense of light, clarity and awareness, and the mind is more or less fixed or still in that position. Not fixed in the sense of, you know, straining against wanting to be somewhere else, but just fixed in the sense of so completely peaceful that there's nothing moving there. Okay? It's important to remember that jhanas are not something that you get, okay? Now sometimes you can't avoid talking in these kinds of language, you know, you sort of get to that stage or something. It's just a way of talking. Actually, when the Buddha talked about them, it's always a process of letting go. Okay? Jhanas are what happens. They're not what happens when you say, I'm going to get a jhana. There's something that happens when you say, I'm going to let go of those things which are defiling and obstructing and distorting my mind. And when you let go of those things, the mind becomes more and more peaceful, and jhanas are the outcome of that process of peace. Okay? That's all. So, have a look at, sometimes it's useful to understand a word, it's useful to know a bit about the background and the context. Remember when the Buddha used this word, he used words, you know, in a way that people were familiar with the word already, and he gave it his own spin on it. The roots of the word is very interesting. I only found this out quite recently, but the roots of the word jhana in the oldest tradition comes from the Rig Veda, where the form that's used is dhi. And the word dhi means something like, it's a very interesting word, and it's a hard one to pin down, but it means something like divine poetic inspiration. Okay? It's the illumination in the mind that flows through when the poet feels like possessed by the gods to praise the Lord, basically. And this is what the Rig Vedas are. Most of them are hymns of praise of various gods and so on. And it was always felt that these were not composed by a person, but that somehow the gods spoke through them. And this sense of illumination that they felt is almost like transcending themselves and speaking these divinely inspired words. And that state of mind was what they called dhi. Yeah? So it's quite nice, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite a nice connotation that the word is sort of carrying inside itself. But the most common word that it's used is in a Sanskrit mantra, which is one of the most common of all the Sanskrit mantras used anywhere. And still used today, it's called the Gayatri Mantra. Does anyone know the Gayatri Mantra? Yeah? Can you recite it for us? Oh, go on.
Om Bhur Bhuvah Svaha Tat Savitur Vairyam Bhagu Devasya Dhimahi Diyuryona Pachoriyatam Shanti Shanti.
Ah, very good. Sadhu, sadhu. So that's from the Rig Veda. It's very more than 2,000 years old, 4,000 years old. And the word dhi is used in there in that same kind of sense, like divinely inspired awakening consciousness. So that's a verse which is sung at the dawn. Okay, so the Brahmins will sing this prayer of homage to the god, which is the sun, Tad Savitur Varenyang, that glorious rising sun, yeah? Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi, whose divine, it means, it's very difficult to translate exactly, but it means something like that, homage to that glorious rising sun whose divine radiance impels my awakening mind towards consciousness. Something like that. Yeah, it's very difficult to translate exactly, but it's something, it's, you can get this idea that you're kind of praying to the sun, the whole world is waking up. There's a light that's coming into your mind, you feel fresh. And you feel like that at the dawn, don't you? When you wake up, and you know there's sort of the clouds of darkness in the nighttime drop off you, and there's a freshness and awakening sense as you're greeting the day. And so this is that kind of sense which that verse is carrying and captures, I think, very beautifully. Remember that when the Buddha became enlightened, he became enlightened at the dawn. Yeah, yeah. The same kind of idea is that the sun's coming up. And it's a beautiful metaphor for that awakening of consciousness, yeah? Bodhi, waking up. That's what we do when the dawn comes. So this is how dhi is used in the oldest scriptures, 1,000 years before the Buddha. Now, I haven't traced the usage, and I haven't seen a trace of the usage, you know, in detail from that time up to the time of the Buddha, but when we find the word being used in the Buddhist scriptures, we find it being used in a few senses. Now, almost always in the Buddhist texts, jhana just means the four jhanas, okay? But there are a few places where it has a more kind of mundane meaning. In one case, it refers to something like a focused intention, like the focused intention that a donkey has when it's looking at its food. Right? So you're just sitting there watching, right? And so this is the kind of jhana that the Buddha says you shouldn't do. Right? So the donkey jhana. Yeah. There's another very interesting use of the word, which is it's not exactly the word jhana, but it's the derived form from the word jhana. And you know the story of when the Buddha when he was still a bodhisattva before he was enlightened, and he went out from the home and then encountered the four sights. You know, the old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then he went back. And back to his house, or back to the palace, and then was kind of brooding about what he'd seen. He was obsessing about it. He couldn't let go of it. He kept on thinking about it again and again. And the word that he uses there is also jhana. There's some, I think it's upanidhyayati or something like that. So it's this idea of like almost kind of, it almost means depression, but it always, in a way, kind of obsessive, you know, going over something, obsessive, repeating, holding on to something. Not very closely related to the meditation meaning of jhana, but it does have that same kind of idea of just like one sticking on one thing, like you see with that donkey, like it's focusing just on one thing. So it has there's some kind of connection, very, very distant one, with the idea of jhana in meditation. So that's just a bit of background in how the word's used in the ordinary language. Now, if we have a look at how the word jhana actually, what it actually means in terms of meditation, one of the things which is very interesting about the way the Buddha taught meditation is that he didn't make too much of a fuss about the details of different meditation techniques. Okay, so these days, if you get a lot of books on meditation, they'll be quite programmatic. You know, they have a lot of different kind of steps, and they say, you know, do this and this and this and so on. And the Buddha did that to some degree, but not nearly so much. Mostly what the Buddha mentioned, mostly what he talked about, was he emphasized the subjective side of meditation. Yeah? It wasn't about the details of the technique, it's about how do you actually respond to that meditation object. Yeah? What is the emotional connection with that? And you see this taught again and again and again and again, so many times. And that feeling of that rapture, a sense of uplift, yeah, a mind which is got a thrill in it, yeah? And then as that sense of rapture matures, then it calms down and becomes what they call prasaddhi, or tranquility, yeah? In the sense of settledness in the mind, yeah? From that settledness, the mind keeps on maturing, keeps on going that same process, and develops what they call sukha. And sukha is a very, very deep sense of pleasure in the mind, okay? Mind and the body. It's called sukha. Right? So the rapture, the earlier stage of rapture is a little bit exciting, yeah? It's a little bit stimulating, and the sukha is very settling. Yeah? It's that very sense of grounding pleasure. So this is that process, that emotional process of response. How do you respond to the meditation? This is what the Buddha talked about again and again. And that process is pretty much the same whatever meditation that you're doing. I mean, it might vary a little bit, right? For example, you find that if you do metta meditation, sometimes it's a bit easier to give rise to those feelings of rapture, so that mind might find, you know, that sense of joy more quickly, more easily through doing loving kindness. Or something like recollection of the Buddha, Buddhanusati meditation. If you have strong faith, then that can also give rise to a lot of rapture very quickly. On the other hand, something like breath meditation doesn't tend to give rise to the sense of joy so quickly, but it tends to give rise to a deeper sense of tranquility. Okay, yeah. So, and then the joy and the pleasure tend to come later. So that's not there's no fundamental difference between these different meditation objects, techniques, but it's just a different tendency, okay? They will tend to emphasize different aspects. But at the end of the day, you have to have all of those things. It's very important to understand. You have to have joy in your meditation. No excuses. You're just going to have to grit your teeth and resign yourself to the fact that you're just going to have to learn to sit there and just be happy for hour after hour after hour every day for the rest of your life, okay?
Shocking.
I know, it's terrible. The things that the Buddha asked us to do. And I know I've mentioned before here that my favourite line in the American Constitution, you have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm. Right? Mm. Very, very profound. You have the right to pursue. You don't have the right to actually get it. Right? You only have the right to pursue it. And it always seems curious, that line. Right, life, liberty, and it always seems to me, I mean, I don't know, this is probably a bit I don't know, a bit dismissive of my American friends. I'm glad Alex isn't here, but the other Alex, American Alex, but, you know, it always seems to be that's the only clause in that constitution that they actually take seriously. Life and liberty seem to be somewhat negotiable, but you lots of capital punishment and lots of people locked up in jails and those kinds of things, but pursuing happiness, yeah, that one they do, yeah, they're really successful at that. So, what the kind of happiness, the difference in the happiness of meditation is, it's not the kind of happiness that you pursue. Huh? And you're not pursuing happiness anymore. Happiness comes to you. Yeah. You know, you have this saying they use in spiritual circles, they say seek within, seek happiness within. Well, that's fair enough, but actually even that doesn't quite capture it. Yeah. You're not even seeking within. Huh? Just let the happiness, that's still pursuing happiness. Right? You still can do the meditation in order to pursue the happiness. Let the happiness come to you. Yeah? Let the happiness come to you. Why does the happiness come? A basic Four Noble Truths. Suffering arises because of our craving and attachments. So if we let go of our craving and attachments, the happiness just naturally comes. Yeah? It's not, you don't have to force it. There's nothing special. It's just, that's how your mind is. Oh, when you're doing that, that's something which is very wholesome, very positive. The mind just naturally starts to become buoyant. The hindrances naturally drop away. And that's how you feel. When suffering ends, you just naturally feel happy. You don't have to make yourself do anything to feel happy. You know, it's like when a prisoner gets released from jail. You know, they don't have to do anything to make themselves feel happy because they're being released from jail, right? They're just happy to be out. When you're sick and you get better, yeah, you don't have to do anything. You're just happy to be healthy. These are, in fact, the similes that the Buddha used to describe what this happiness is. Yeah? One of the most powerful and most beautiful of all the Buddha suttas is the Samanipala Sutta, the fruits of the ascetic life. And the Buddha talks all the way through this. The whole theme of that sutta was King Ajatasattu asked the Buddha, you know, when we're living in our worldly life, we can do these various crafts and livelihoods and we can find happiness in doing them and we can earn a living and we can bring happiness to ourselves and our family. Is there any happiness from pursuing the spiritual life? And so the Buddha gave this very long and beautiful sutta where he talks about at each stage in the development of your spiritual life, you feel yourself, within yourself, a happiness, a blameless happiness, a pure happiness, and one which deepens at each step of the path. Okay, so rather than thinking of jhanas as being like a state of meditation which I've got to sort of do this method in order to attain, we think of it as how can I cultivate my spiritual happiness, right? So rather than thinking what is the right meditation method that is going to get me to jhana, think about what do I do, what are those things in my life that actually make me happy, yeah, that actually give me that kind of genuine happiness, a real spiritual happiness. Maybe it's helping people. Yeah? Maybe it's giving dana. Maybe it's reading or reciting the Buddha's words. Maybe it's just going for a walk in the park. Think about what that is for yourself. What is that thing that actually makes you happy? Maybe it's being with your grandchildren or something like that. Maybe it's... Who knows what it is? It's different for everyone. But you think about that. Think about what is those things that give me a genuinely... happy, a wholesome happiness in yourself. I remember one time, a number of years ago, I was at Sang Bodhnyana Monastery, not this time, but when I was there more than 10 years ago. And at that time I was on a retreat, and during the intensive retreats for the monks there, we just stay in our hut, and somebody brings us the food, so basically you don't see anybody for 2 weeks. I think I was on retreat for a month at that time. So the only thing that we come out of retreat for is for the talk, the Dhamma talk on a Wednesday night. And so that period, as it happened, Ajahn Brahm was also on retreat. So he didn't give the talk that Wednesday, but there was another monk who was visiting, a senior monk, and he gave the talk on that Wednesday. And that monk was not really kind of expert Dhamma teacher, right? He was more of a kind of quiet personality. He didn't really like giving Dhamma talks and so on, but we persuaded him to give a talk, and he said, okay, he'll just tell about some of his experiences as a monk and living in Thailand and Sri Lanka and so on. So, and he gave his talk, and he ended up telling these very, very funny stories about his experiences in Thailand and experiences in Sri Lanka and so on, and all of the completely outrageous situations that he found himself in as a monk in the forest and so on. Now, I won't go into some of the stories here. They're a bit too funny, actually. But anyway, and that probably wouldn't be funny if he wasn't telling him because of his experience. But anyway, and we just really kind of laughed a lot. It's kind of amazing, really, because Ajahn Brahm, you know, normally he's known for telling jokes and stuff with his stories. But like when this monk gave his stories, we really laughed. And and I remember coming back from that Dhamma talk, you know, thinking, oh, you know, my mind was like really peaceful. I was having a really good retreat. Like my mind was really peaceful before going into that Dhamma talk. And I remember coming back and thinking, oh, you know, my mind will be really agitated now because I've just spent like 2 hours just laughing, right? So, you know, my mind's going to be much more stimulated than it was before. And then I went back to my hut. Now I had the best meditation I had in the whole retreat, yeah? And it was one of the few times when I just sat down in meditation and it just happened without any doing anything. It was just felt so natural, yeah? And I really learned a very good lesson for that. Yeah? Actually, you know, I could have stayed in my hut and just watched my breath coming in and out for those 2 hours instead of going and listening to that talk. My meditation would not have been as good. Yeah? What is it that makes you happy? What is it that gives you that wholesome happiness? That's what's going to lead to the deep meditation. Yeah? Not XYZ meditation method, not making yourself sit for many hours every day, not finding the perfect teacher who's going to tell you what meditation you did in your past life so that you can cheat and do it again in this life, right? None of those things are important. Well, not that they're unimportant. They're just details, okay? So you can do those things, it's just details. But the important thing is, how do you find that sense of happiness? In fact, that connection is so close in the way that the Buddha talked and in the suttas it became quite a common idiom that the word sukha or pleasure is virtually a synonym for the four jhanas. Okay, so they can use actually almost interchangeably. For example, one example of that is when the anumodana verse, which we recite when the blessing is offering. You say, for anybody who makes these kind of offering and generosity, then they get four dhammas will increase. That's ayu, vanno, sukhang, balang. Yeah? And when ayu means long life, vanna means beauty, sukha means happiness, bala means health. Yeah? And they just have ordinary, straightforward meanings. It's just a very simple kind of blessing that you say, and it's something that any ordinary person can relate to. But in the suttas, the Buddha also gives a Dhamma explanation of each one of those four things. And so ayu, long life, is practice of the four idipadas, yeah, four bases of psychic power, because that's what you can do to extend your lifespan. Vanna is sila, or the ethics. Yeah, so beauty is your ethics. Sukha, pleasure, is the four jhanas. Yeah? And bala is the power or the strength to get rid of all of the defilements and realize enlightenment. Yeah? So sukha, in that case, is an equivalent to the four jhanas. And that's not alone. That's quite a characteristic idiom of how the Buddha taught. Another example, so the Buddha was criticized because he said, somebody criticized him and said, your monks are just addicted to a life of pleasure. Right? And this is kind of a fairly typical criticism that some of the Jains and other ascetics at the time made of the Buddhists because they were kind of the Jains like really severe, you know, you pull your hair out and you stand on one leg and all of this kind of stuff. And the Buddhists were really kind of, from their point of view, like really sloppy, right? Mm. And we ate good food and had a nice monastery and stuff. So that's how they used to criticize. So they said, you Buddhists, you're supposed to be a spiritual teacher, but your followers are just addicted to a life of pleasure. Yeah, they were sukha likanu yoga, something like that. And the Buddha said, well, yes, in a way you're quite right. You know, my followers are in fact addicted to a life of pleasure. They're addicted to four kinds of pleasure. What kinds of pleasure? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and fourth jhana. Yeah, so they're addicted to that kind of pleasure. And when they're addicted to that kind of pleasure, what kind of outcome can they expect? He says stream entry, once return, non-return, arahantship, the four stages of enlightenment. So that's the outcome of being addicted to a life of pleasure. Yeah? Yeah. So this is what those jhanas are. Yeah? So we don't think of them as something which is very far away, very difficult. They're very close. Okay, jhanas are just states of mind. And again, this is one of the other innovations which the Buddha brought into the spiritual scene in India. I think he was the first person who ever described these things purely in straightforward psychological terms. Right? And we find in other spiritual literatures, like in the Upanishads and so on, we find this kind of evocation and sort of a sort of inspired sayings which seem to be referring to different states of meditation, but we don't find any clear description of what those states are, and we don't find any clear description of how to attain them. And so this is what the Buddha gave both of those things. And so he said, well, you know, when you meditate, when you let go of your attachments, when you let go of your worries, when you let go of all of those things that are causing affliction in your mind, then you'll notice that emotional, that pattern of emotional response, of that rapture, that tranquility, that bliss, that process of a deepening and deepening sense of pleasure in the mind. And when the mind becomes so filled with pleasure and so content, it just comes in and stays in that one place. Yeah? And so Suhupanisara Samadhi, sukha, is the immediate cause, the vital cause of samadhi, the unification of mind. So samadhi doesn't mean concentration. Samadhi means something like stillness or oneness or coalescence of the mind, where everything comes together as one. In the first, what they call the first jhana, there's five factors. And the Buddha always used to describe the first jhana. Vitaka vichara piti sukha ekagata. Actually, he doesn't. Ekagata is often not mentioned, it's only occasionally mentioned in the context of the first jhana. But anyway, the first jhana is said to have five factors. Vitaka vichara piti sukha ekagata. Now, each one of those is just an ordinary mental quality, which all of you have. Okay, so all of you have these things, but they need to be developed and they need to be purified. So it's through developing and purifying those ordinary aspects of our mind that we reach these very extraordinary states of consciousness, what we would have called states which are above or beyond the human. So those factors, vitaka, means the application of the mind, moving the mind onto the meditation. So this is what you do, for example, when you sit down to meditate and you're going to watch your breath and you bring the mind to the breath. Okay? That's vitaka. Okay? And then your mind wanders off, gets distracted, and then you bring your mind back. This is vitaka. Yeah? It's thinking of the breath. Not thinking about the breath, but bringing attention to the breath. Okay? And so in your meditation, you'll notice that this has a kind of rhythm to it, right? And the mind isn't a static thing, right? So you don't like point attention to something and just stays there, right? It's not like a camera which you just point somewhere and it sits in that thing. The mind, it's almost like I think that the mind is designed actually to be on the move all the time. It's probably like an evolutionary thing maybe. You sort of have to be aware of your environment, your surroundings and so on. So it's actually meant to be active and to move around. So you have to sort of just train it. You can't make it be still, but you can bring it, have, give it a rhythm. You'll notice this kind of rhythm emerges in the mind where you can keep on bringing it back to the breath and training that awareness very gently. Yeah? This is the vitaka. The vichara is when it's staying there. Right? So the vitaka is a sense of an ongoing. So when you bring the mind to the breath, I'm just using the breath as an example. I've already said that it doesn't matter which meditation you use. But you bring the mind to the breath and you're keeping it there, and then maybe kind of it wanders off. So you bring it back again and then maybe it wanders off. So this is the bringing it in is the vitaka, keeping it there is the vichara. Okay, so as that becomes more well established, as the tendency of the mind to wander off gradually fades away and the strength of the meditation is increasing, and what you kind of notice is that it's almost like the mind is just kind of massaging the breath. It's sort of there most of the time. It might still occasionally wander off, but it's coming back more and more, and it's sort of just sort of, again, this is that vitaka vichara kind of staying with. And the Buddha used a simile like massaging a ball of bath powder. I think they're called chunam. I don't even know what bath powder is, but apparently, have you used bath powder? Apparently like a kind of powder that you'd have and you'd mix it up with a bit of water. A bit like, I think it's a bit like dough or something like that. It's obviously not doughy, but the idea is you mix it up and you kind of knead it to get it to the right consistency, right? And then you can sort of use it for cleaning yourself with, I guess, some kind of mud or something like that. So even though we're not very familiar with the thing, but that's the basic idea. You sort of have to keep on kneading. That's the simile he gave for the vitaka vichara. Yeah? It's at the same place. So the vitaka vichara is not moving around to different things. It's still with that one thing. Yeah? It's still contained in that one thing. But there's a sort of sense of massaging that thing. So this is the vitaka vichara. Piti is a sense of rapture, a sense of uplift. Initially, the uplift comes because we let go of the coarser forms of suffering that we're experiencing. Coarser forms of suffering through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and also we're starting to let, because our mind's starting to get more in the present, we're starting to let go of the past and the future, we're starting to let go of all of our worries and fears and expectations, and the mind starts to lift, it has a buoyancy to it, yeah, like a balloon, a hot air balloon, and you're letting go all the sandbags, yeah, it sort of starts to lift up, and this is that sense of piety, that rapture that comes into the mind at that time. So the Buddha, the simile the Buddha used to describe the rapture, he said, was like in a cool forest pool where there's no water, there's no rain, and there's no water coming in and out. Like there's no streams feeding the pool and nothing going out. So again, this idea that's contained, right, within one place. But there was a spring underneath the water, underneath the pool, and the water was welling up from the spring, so you had this cool water welling up from the spring. So this is, that gives you very, very, Buddha's similes are so wonderful, he gives this so wonderful idea that sense of rapture welling up inside you. Yeah? So this is the rapture. Piti Sukha is, I've already mentioned, is translated as bliss or pleasure, and it's much more settled. So whereas the rapture tends to be lifting up, the sukha is settling down, okay, and it's the sukha, so it's the rapture which keeps our interest, keeps the sense of engagement, right, with our meditation. But it's the sukha which brings a sense of deep sense of contentment. We don't want to be anywhere else, okay? So the sukha, you know, to think of the sukha is like it's a stormy, cold night and you're inside and you've closed all the windows and you've got a roaring fire on the fireplace and you're sitting in front of there in a nice soft rocking chair and you're rocking backwards and forwards and you've got a pussy cat on your lap and you're stroking the cat and you've got a glass of port that you're drinking. No, no, you can't drink that because breaking the precepts, but you've got a nice cup of herbal tea that you're drinking. And you're just so content. And you know that you should really go to bed. You know, it's time to go to bed. But you're just so happy to be there. I'll just stay for a little while longer because I'm just too content. I don't want to be anywhere else. Yeah? So that's that sense of sukha. So, yeah, you should think of your meditation object, right? You shouldn't think of meditation as being, you know, I'm going to have to go and do my 15 minutes or my 20 minutes or my half an hour and get my thing done in and, oh, can I find an excuse to not do it? Oh, I have to clean the microwave. Oh, that's good. At least that's more fun than meditating. Right? So, you know, how do you think of meditation? Ah, you sit down and so comfortable. And you just don't want to go anywhere else. Oh, please, just let me keep on doing this for a little bit longer. Yeah? That is what leads to stillness and samadhi. Yeah? Not making yourself, you know, keep on bashing away at some meditation object. And the last of the jhana factors is ekagata, yeah? Is unification, literally unification, right? Sometimes they're translated as one-pointedness, but it's not a very good translation. It doesn't mean one-pointedness, and there's no pointiness about it, okay? In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's where there's no, it should be better called no-pointiness, okay? There's nothing pointy about it, right? So ekagata, everything is one, okay? Now that can be understood on a number of dimensions, a number of aspects. One thing it means is that there's no sense consciousness, right? Sense consciousness is always a plurality, yeah? Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, there's many things. No, there's just one thing, mind consciousness. Mind consciousness doesn't change, right? It stays the same. That means there's no time. Right? Think about it. What is time? Time is awareness of change, isn't it? If we don't see anything change, time is, we wouldn't have any idea of time. So, nothing changes. So everything is the present all the time. It's very, very powerful when you realize that. You know, we talk a lot about being in the present when we're in meditation, but normally the present that we're in meditation is a very shallow present, right? It's a present which teeters precariously between the past and the future, okay? And whereas this is a present where the past and the future simply don't exist. All there is the present, that's all there ever has been, that's all there ever will be. This is what they sometimes call the eternal present. Yeah? It's not eternal in the sense that it lasts forever, it obviously comes to an end, but it's just eternal in the sense that while you're in that state, there's no awareness of change. It's also another very important aspect of the unification is it's a sense of the balance and integration of all of the other factors. Okay, that's very, very important. So one, unification means that all of those other factors, all the vitaka, the initial application, the vichara, the sustained application, the rapture, the pleasure, all of those are present, all of those are fully developed, all of those are working together in exactly the right way, balanced and harmonious and perfect. And that sense of unification comes with a very deep sense of naturalness. Yeah? A very deep sense of like this, conflicts have fallen away. Yeah? And that is actually one of the really defining aspects of the experience of jhana. When different people experience it, people will describe that experience in different ways. Okay? And the experience of entering a jhana can be described in many different ways. Some people will say it's like falling down a well. Right? Some people it's like it's like the sun appears in their mind and they step through a door and become one with the sun. Yeah, something like that. Others it's like stepping into another world. So these are kind of just attempts at kind of a subjective impression of describing what this experience is like, right? But in a sense, the manner of how we experience it isn't so important. What's important is the that we understand the process that led to that experience. And we understand that process is a process not of getting and gaining things, but it's a process of gradual letting go. The Buddha described the sequence of jhanas as anubhubha nirodha, right? A gradual cessation. So jhanas are not gained by getting something, they're gained by the ending of something. Yeah? And that's what you're experiencing right from the beginning of your meditation. When you first sit down to meditate, you can let go of your duties and jobs and external responsibilities. All I have to do is sit here quietly. That's a letting go. And you feel peaceful because of that. Then you can let go of the past and the future. You can let go of your worries. You can let go of all of the things that are causing you distress. The more you pay attention to the meditation object, the more you let go of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, more refined forms of thoughts and distracted mind and so on. Gradually you let go of all those things and you find more and more pleasure. Deeper sense of pleasure arises the more you let go of everything. And following that process, the more you let go of everything, it gives you more faith. Every step of the way, it gives you that faith. Oh, I can let go. Because we hold on to things, right? Why do we hold on to them? Because we're afraid to let go of them. What's going to happen? Right? You've seen that when you've moved house, right? You go through these boxes of stuff. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to... Yeah, I know it's still in the box from when I moved last time, right? But, you know, you never know when it might come in handy. Right? You're afraid to let go of it. Right? And so, little bit by little bit. Like, and when you have that faith in that letting go, and this is actually a very interesting sutta, when Buddha, or I think it might have been Venerable Sariputta, was asked about how we can understand that Nibbana is blissful when there's nothing felt there, right? How is Nibbana blissful when there's nothing to feel? And Sariputta said, it's exactly because there's nothing to feel, that's why it's blissful, yeah? And that's a very paradoxical statement. One of the fantastic things about the Buddha's teachings, the teachers will give these very paradoxical statements, right? It sounds, doesn't make sense. But he doesn't just leave it there. He also explains how you actually see that for yourself. And the way he explained that one was through the process of the four jhanas. Exactly what I've been talking about, that each time with the jhanas, you let go of certain things, yeah? You let go of the five hindrances. You let go of your attachment to the sense objects. You let go of then through the process of jhanas, you initially let go of the vitaka vichara, the movement of the mind towards the object, the keeping of the mind with the object. You let go of that, and the second jhana, the mind is just completely still and has the rapture and the bliss. And the third, then you let go of the rapture, and then that's what we call the third jhana. Even that subtle excitement or that feeling of rapture is gone, and we call that the third jhana. But then even the bliss, right? Even that deep sense of pleasure is still a something. Yeah? And then we let go of that, because in the fourth jhana it's just equanimity. And you realize actually the equanimity is in some subtle way even more peaceful and more blissful than even that profound sense of bliss. And then that process keeps on going. At each step you understand, oh, through letting go and through the cessation of things, there's a more profound sense of happiness, a sense of happiness that goes beyond the feeling, goes beyond any kind of feeling at all. So this is that process by which the jhanas happen. And this is why the jhanas are such powerful vehicles for the development of insight, because they've arisen through the letting go of defilements. Then as you emerge from the jhana, mind will naturally go back and want to investigate. People ask this kind of question sometimes, you know, how do you combine vipassana and meditation with the jhanas? Honestly, for you guys, it's not going to be a problem, right? Your problem is making your mind peaceful, right? Full stop, right? There are some people whose mind is very, very naturally peaceful, right? They just sit there and meditate, and then, oh, they just sit, and oh, it's so peaceful, happy. And they just can sit there for hour after hour after hour. Never have. Is that anybody here? Huh? Does exist. But if you're like that, then maybe you need to be taught how to do some insight meditation at the end of the practice of jhanas, right? You need to know what do you do and how do you investigate, how do you see impermanence, because that's all you've known is that sense of peace and that sense of stillness. But you guys have all struggled, right? Yeah, you've done some vipassana, you've done these retreats, you know what impermanence is, right? You know what it means to suffer. And you understand the Dhamma enough to know that you can reflect on this experience, that it's not impermanent, that if you attach to this experience, it'll just give you suffering and all those things. So you know those things already. When you come out of the jhana, your mind will have so much clarity and power in it, it will know all those things far more deeply. Right? And so your knowing and your insight will just penetrate naturally and smoothly and easily and clearly. Okay? You've just upgraded from a bicycle to a BMW. Okay? And from then on, that will be easy, right? Your insight will just flow, okay? So you don't need to worry about that too much, right? The main thing is just learning to be peaceful, yeah? Learning to not be too attached to all of these things that we hang on to our sense of self and that we cause suffering for ourselves. Okay, so this is a talk about jhanas.